Good afternoon. I'm Rhonda Feynman, and this is the Healthy Options program right here on WERU Community Radio. Today's guest is Eileen Hawkins, certified stroke registered nurse and certified neuroscience registered nurse, who serves as the stroke program coordinator at Penobscot Bay Medical Center in Rockport, Maine. Eileen Hawkins has become well known in Maine for her public presentations on stroke awareness, prevention, and treatment. In addition, Eileen Hawkins has developed and implemented the first secondary stroke prevention clinic right here in Maine, focusing on post-stroke assessment and screening, monitoring, referrals, risk factor assessment, and education. She's also an active member and a founding member of the Maine Stroke Alliance, a coordinated system of stroke care throughout Maine that addresses stroke education and prevention, acute and subacute stroke treatment, stroke recovery, rehabilitation, and community reintegration, and secondary stroke prevention. Welcome to Healthy Options, Eileen Hawkins. We're so glad you are able to come and talk with us today to discuss stroke awareness, prevention, and treatment.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So you're just so experienced with all of this. I guess we should just start at the beginning. What do we mean when we say stroke? What is a stroke?
So stroke is the sudden onset of essentially a neurological deficit, which impacts some form of our neurologic and functional being, our ability to function normally and move through life and talk and speak and communicate. It's characterized very clearly by the sudden onset of these symptoms. Certainly people can come to the emergency department with some of these symptoms, and they may have been going on for days. They may have been going on for hours. What we're always going to ask the person is, did this symptom come on suddenly? So, yep. And so there are five key suddens that we kind of try to teach to people, to the community, to people in the public, and patients once they've had a stroke, so they can recognize if they have another one. And it's really key that we remind people of kind of the five that I'll kind of go through quickly. It's sudden onset of numbness or weakness of the face, arm, or leg, especially on one side of the body, usually one side versus the other, not both sides kind of thing. It's one side or the other. And it can be numbness and or weakness. And sometimes it's just an arm, sometimes it's just a leg, sometimes it's just the face, but it's any new numbness or weakness on one side of the body is a possible sign of a stroke. Another possible sign is sudden onset of confusion, trouble speaking, and misunderstanding. So if all of a sudden you don't know you're watching TV and you can't process what they're saying, or you're talking to your family member or on the phone, and you just, we'll hear very commonly people say, I was just talking to them, and all of a sudden they just couldn't respond. They either don't understand or they can't respond back. They can't speak. So any sudden onset of confusion, trouble speaking or understanding. And when people come into the hospital with confusion, that's sometimes, especially if it's a new onset, that's sometimes a sign of a stroke to us, that people in the community or someone coming in may not recognize that as a possible sign of a stroke. But if that's a new onset of sudden trouble speaking or understanding, that's a possible sign of a stroke. Another is trouble seeing in one or both eyes. So people can lose vision in one eye. They can lose vision in certain quadrants of both eyes. Their vision can become blurry. They might have weak eye movements, and that's causing the eyes to not move simultaneously together. And that can create blurry vision because the nerves of the eye muscles might be impaired. So any trouble, new onset of trouble seeing in one or both eyes is a possible sign of a stroke. The next possible sign is trouble walking, dizziness, loss of balance or coordination. And that's a toughie because dizziness is so multifactorial. There are 100 reasons for dizziness. And again, we're going back to, is this a sudden onset? And is the person coming in with a sudden onset of dizziness? Sometimes that's hard to tell. And I want to remind people while I'm talking to people that sudden onset, you can really define if you wake up with something that you did not go to bed with, you're probably going to want to consider that a sudden onset in terms of if you wake up and your face and your arm are numb, and it wasn't that way when you went to bed or yesterday, we will call that a possible wake-up stroke, someone who had a stroke in the middle of the night and they come to see us. So we don't want people to, go back to bed and, you know, and think, maybe I'll feel better if I just sleep on my other side or something like that. So if you wake up with something that you did not have before or it's new, that's the, you know, a sign. And then the fifth sudden that I like to remind people is a sign of a possible stroke. And again, this is multifactorial, but the sudden onset of a severe headache with no known cause. Okay. So if all of a sudden you are hit with a headache out of the blue, that's a possible sign of stroke. I want to be clear to this with the public that these are all possible signs of stroke. You need to get them checked out. And again, there are a lot of reasons for headaches, but when someone says to me, or to the emergency department nurses and doctors, I had the sudden onset of a headache, that's my sign. I'm going to look to see, is there possibly a bleed? Is what's happened quickly that made this person have a sudden onset of a headache? So we want to look at all those things. So in a nutshell, sudden numbness or weakness of the face, arm or leg, one side of the body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing in one or both eyes, sudden trouble walking or problems with dizziness, balance or coordination, and sudden severe headache with no known cause. Those are the five warning signs of a possible stroke.
Right. And yes, and we're going to be repeating these. There are other be fast. We'll talk about all of this.
Be fast as a way to identify that. Right.
Right. And we'll talk about what stroke can I identify. Well, let's just say it now. And then what we'll do is we'll talk about what is a stroke anyway. But B is for balance, right? E is for eye and vision. Mm-hmm. And the fast is... I think we have the same piece of paper here.
F is for face. Okay. So A is, this is an acronym that we try to teach people going home with stroke families. So I just gave you guys a list of five possible warning signs of stroke. And I want to back up and say one thing. Sometimes a person can have one thing and sometimes they can have a couple things. They could have weakness and eye problems, or they could have just weakness. So you could have three things, you know, but any of those sudden onset of any of those things is a possible sign of stroke. So how do you recognize that? So if you are a family member, friend, if you're in the grocery store, you're anywhere, in the hospital, anywhere, we use this acronym BFAST, and that is sort of a way to help people. If someone, you see somebody with a possible new sign of a stroke, we in the hospital, in the emergency room, would say, hey, they have a positive BFAST. And that's our clue that we're going to work up a stroke. And a BFAST implies this is a new symptom. So anybody that walks into the ER with confusion isn't necessarily a positive BFAST, because they could be confused for a million reasons. So what we're going to do is get a little history and say, when did this confusion come on? What's it like? That kind of thing. But if you're at home or you're anywhere with anyone and they have sudden onset of something with balance, B for balance, if they're dizzy all of a sudden, they have difficulty with balance or coordination. E, if you notice they can't see, if they tell you they can't see, if their eye becomes crooked, one eye moves one way and one the other, or they can't move their eyes in conjugation. F, face, is the face weak or numb? That's a very common hallmark sign of a possible stroke. A lot of people recognize that one very readily. A person's upper and or lower face might be crooked and not moving the way, or when they smile, their smile is quite asymmetric and their face doesn't move. That's BEF. A, arm, stands for arm or leg, weakness or numbness. S stands for speech or language difficulties. They have some problems with their speech or language. And T is time. Time to call 911, time to move fast, time to get to the hospital, time to let us evaluate you to see if this is indeed a stroke and can we do something in those very early hours and minutes.
So we'll, as I said here on Healthy Options, we're going to be mentioning those again. Let's back up just for a moment, but what is happening when you have these things? What is a stroke?
A stroke is essentially It comes from the word struck, to be struck out of the blue, a blow. The long old meaning of the word strike is a blow. And it's out of the blue, to be struck from out of the blue. And it's also called, it's formally called, and still see it like this sometimes, a cerebrovascular accident, a CVA. Every once in a while you'll see that. Although we don't use that term as much in the hospital, because I'll get into this in a little bit, but we kind of almost say strokes aren't accidents too much. They're really many strokes. Most strokes, in fact, according to the American Heart and Stroke Association, will tell you that about 80% of strokes can be prevented. So we kind of almost use a little bit of a misnomer, but say it's a cerebrovascular accident, but that's kind of a beside the point. But what a stroke is a sudden onset of a disruption of blood flow to part of the brain. And whatever part of the brain gets disrupted, whatever function is associated with that part of the brain is going to become impaired. And I kind of, urge everyone to think pretty much everything in your brain does something. There's a lot of parts of the brain. There's a lot of things. Our brain controls our movement, our sensations, our coordination, our cognition, our speech. Our brain controls pretty much everything. So if a piece of the brain doesn't get blood flow because a vessel gets blocked or a vessel ruptures and is broken, if it doesn't get the blood flow it needs, that part of the brain is not going to work correctly. And that part of that's going to be manifested by either one of those signs of stroke that I talked about. You either will become paralyzed or possibly lose vision or sensation or speech. So, and kind of almost makes a little sense that the more of the brain that doesn't get blood flow, possibly the worse the stroke is. Is it a big artery in the neck and the entire half of my brain is cut off? That's going to be a far worse stroke. Functionally, it's going to be much worse stroke than a small vessel that is going to a very small part of the brain. Now, I want to also be clear that even though small vessels maybe don't go to a big part of the brain, it may be going to a very important part of the brain. What part of your functioning isn't really vital to the things you do every day? So you really want to know that. Bottom line is it's pretty much a disease of the arteries of the brain, and they're either blocked or they burst. I will want to stress that the blockage type of stroke is so much more common. About 85 to 87% of all strokes in the world are the blockage sort.
And that's called
an ischemic stroke, ischemic, meaning ischemia. And you've all heard the word MI, myocardial ischemia. Well, this is cerebral ischemia. So it's an ischemic stroke. The vast majority of strokes are ischemic in nature. The rest of the 13 to 15% of strokes that do occur, and we do see them, are hemorrhagic strokes, where a blood vessel ruptures. Unfortunately, and patients can do well with those. We have amazing treatments now, and patients can do well. But in general, hemorrhagic strokes are the more fatal of the two types of stroke, because they can be, both types of stroke can be quite bad. But hemorrhagic strokes in general tend to be a more fatal stroke. That said, many people have hemorrhagic strokes. We treat them, and they can do well, as long as we begin to treat the underlying reason for the hemorrhage. So those are the two types of stroke, ischemic and hemorrhagic.
But then there's sometimes people have a stroke and we don't know what it is. What do we call that?
Well, yes. They're an ischemic stroke or a hemorrhagic stroke. If you, if you're referring to what we call a cryptogenic stroke, mm-hmm. Someone will come in, we don't know why they had a stroke. Really what that refers to is we don't know what caused that stroke. We might see a stroke. They might have a functional deficit. They might have a deficit on their CAT scan or their MRI. They've had a stroke, but we cannot find the etiology of that stroke. We can't find AFib. They don't have high blood pressure. They don't have diabetes. They don't have all the traditional risk factors. And that's something called a cryptogenic stroke. So what we do is we send people home And we continue the workup as an outpatient at that point. We might send them home on heart monitors, looking for an occult heart rhythm that might show up in a few weeks. You know, they might be in and out of a rhythm. It didn't show up while they're in the hospital, but then we send them home. And sure enough, we look at the monitor results in a few weeks and we say, oh, look it. They've been in and out of AFib, and we never captured that while they were in the hospital. That's probably the most common scenario, I'm going to venture to guess that. But every once in a while, someone will have a stroke and we just don't have. And same thing with hemorrhages. Every once in a while, someone will have a rupture of, and we can't pinpoint it to an aneurysm. We don't know. So there are things called cryptogenic stroke, but.
Mm. Oh, yes. And you've just mentioned so many factors that we're going to go into, the things that could cause a stroke, ways of preventing a stroke. And for those who have just tuned in, I'm Rhonda Fineman. This is the Healthy Options Program right here on WERU Community Radio. Our guest today is neuroscience nurse Eileen Hawkins, who is the Stroke Program Coordinator at Penn Bay Medical Center. We're talking about stroke awareness, prevention, and treatment. There's so many ways to go here with all the information you've just given us. We've been going through the symptoms, and as I said, we'll always keep mentioning that, and we'll have everything archived, and you'll have all the links to information about what we're talking about. What can prevent a stroke, or what can cause a stroke?
So that's a good question. So backing up to something I alluded to earlier, as I said, in younger years, when I was a young nurse, or years ago, and most of us have heard this, you'll still see it floating around, but we still will say a stroke is a CVA, a cerebral vascular accident. And what that is damage to a vessel in the brain. Okay. And I'm going to dovetail this conversation on an important concept that I really try to stress when I talk to the community and talk to patients and families. I want to stress that heart disease, heart attack, let's say heart attack, myocardial infarction or ischemia and infarction, heart attack is the same disease as a stroke. We might as well call stroke a brain attack. It is the same mechanism of injury to the arteries. So it's very, very simple concept to come basically embrace the notion that if we can prevent heart disease, heart attack, we can prevent stroke. For decades, our country has focused on prevention of heart disease. How do you treat a heart attack? Everybody in the world learns CPR. Everyone in the everybody's on every beta blocker, alpha blocker, or and we have amazing surgeries. Stroke, which is a brain attack, has very closely paralleled that process, but a few decades or at least behind it. So everything that we've done over the years with heart attack to prevent and treat heart attack is now happening with stroke because it is the same disease. And finally, over many decades, people have come, healthcare providers, the public have begun to know, God, if I can prevent a heart attack, I can prevent a stroke. And I tell people, there's one bottom line. If you're at risk of a heart attack, you're at risk of a stroke. Period. That's it. It's the same disease process. What I will tell people, most people have manifestations of their heart disease before they have a stroke. I say this almost in every talk that I give. I can probably count on in all the years that I've been doing this on my two hands, maybe one, the number of people that I know that have had a stroke that don't have some form of cardiovascular disease as well, whether it's hypertension, whether it is a hole in the heart, whether it is coronary artery disease, a previous heart attack, some type of cardiac problem, hyperlipidemia,
AFib.
AFib, an arrhythmia. It's very uncommon to see someone have a stroke that doesn't have some type of cardiovascular disease. That said, once in a blue moon, as you mentioned, Rhonda, there's something called a cryptogenic stroke. Sometimes somebody will come in and like, we will work them up and we'll all be scratching our heads because we can't find a source of that blood clot that went to the brain or, you know, that kind of thing. But that said, now let's talk about that. For decades, we have been trying to teach the public, and the American Heart and Stroke Association have tried to teach the public, listen, we can prevent heart attacks. 80% of heart attacks and strokes are related to lifestyle factors. So for that reason, that's why I kind of always say CVA, cerebral vascular accident, is a little bit of a misnomer, because it's not really. In theory, we can prevent much heart disease and stroke. It's hard to prevent some of it in terms of as we get older and we have habits or we have, you know, if, but what we need to do is early on start knowing what the risk factors for heart disease and try to prevent. That is our goal, prevent the heart disease and the stroke. So what are the factors that cause? First and foremost, I want to say that some heart attacks and stroke are not going to be necessarily preventable, because I can't underscore enough the role of heredity in cerebrovascular and cardiovascular disease. You can do everything right. You can literally do everything right. You can exercise. You can eat no meat, never have smoked a cigarette. You could do everything right, and you still could have a cholesterol through the roof if you have familial hypercholesterolemia. You and you know, if you'll, whenever we go to the doctors, the first question out of our doctors, especially when they're taking our initial history, is, when did your mother die? How did your mother die? How old was your mother when she died? How old was your father when he died? Because they want to hear, when I go to the hospital, if I say my mother died at 52 of a heart attack, that's a big red flag that maybe I am at risk of heart disease, and I need to really know that that's a potential risk factor in my family. So we always want to know what our family history is, because the role of heredity in cardiovascular disease and cerebrovascular disease subsequently is quite powerful. So what I always tell people is, if you know that a first degree relative has hypertension, has had a heart attack and a stroke for whatever reason, you are automatically at a little bit more risk than someone that doesn't have that family history. So that's number one. Or you have the propensity to possibly have those same risk factors, get out of control kind of thing. So that's number one. So about some strokes, we're not going to be able to prevent. The second thing is, in general, stroke is a disease of the older population. Certainly there are young people that have strokes. And in fact, yes. And strokes are on the rise in people aged 45 to 60. That is the highest, the most rapidly growing population of people having new strokes, 45 to 60 year olds. The older people are still having more, but we're seeing more and more people in those 45 to 60 have strokes. So certainly it is, tends to be a disease of the older population. However, younger people can indeed have strokes. In fact, even infants and small children can have strokes if they have certain conditions. We don't see that much at all. That's not what we see a lot at all. But we do see 30, 40, 50-year-old people having strokes, not that uncommonly.
So right. There could be a malformation of a blood vessel, and right? And
then there could be many things.
A hole in the heart, perhaps, and that can get, especially in younger people. I'm finding that a very interesting statistic as well, because we hear about that with young women, with women in cancer, uterine and breast cancers. So there's something happening where in the past we would say these are diseases of people 80 years old, but now we're seeing them in younger people. And of course, that's another study that and conversation that needs to happen with what's happening.
Well, we do know is there are higher rates of metabolic syndrome, higher rates of diabetes and hypertension in younger people now. From, you know, so because we're seeing those risk factors occur more, we are seeing more stroke. It's just that simple. It's that we are at risk as a nation of cardiovascular and cerebrovascular disease. So it is those same processes that are causing us to have heart attacks and strokes are happening in younger populations now. You know,
I'm just wondering. We know about stress, and we'll talk about that. I'd love to hear your take on that. But also, when we talk about the brain, and that's what we're talking about, right? What's happening in the brain, we know, and as you've mentioned, we have different parts of the brain that do different things. The right side of the brain does one thing, the left side. And then we have part of the brain that coordinates it all so that we're actually working together. And some of the reading I've done, and I know, is that the right side of the brain actually has a lot to do with almost a way of calming the nervous system, that we're getting that sensation we're not so separate. We're not in the detail left brain part of ourselves. You know, I have to do this and I have 15 appointments and I'm going to coordinate them all. And oh my gosh, I have to deal with the kids and my mother's sick. And oh my goodness, what am I going to do? I better have a drink or a cigarette or whatever. And that it's almost like if we work with things like meditation or ways of calming the nervous system, which is really kind of our right brain aspect, you know, we could cool things out a little bit. That's another way of dealing with hypertension, another way of dealing with, of really looking at how our brains work on that structural level. And this is real science. This is, that would give us a sense of what other things do we do to help keep ourselves at a more balanced level. What do you know about that in the treatment aspect that you're working on?
What I would say is that there is a definite role in both the prevention and the treatment, okay? Both the prevention and the treatment of lifestyle types of behaviors, okay? Many people find great success with meditation and yoga to bring down their stress levels, which subsequently could impact their glucose, their blood pressure, their anxiety, all the things that lead to, you know, can be part of the cycle of problems that exacerbate problems that cause stroke. So I'm here to say very clearly that there are very known causes of stroke, things like high blood pressure, diabetes. You can't sit here alone and say stress alone causes stroke, right? But the cortisol release, the changes in our glucose, the stress, the anxiety, those can all be minimized or abated or somehow mitigated some way for many people with things like yoga, meditation, deep breathing. So those can be adjuncts to healthy living to help prevent. And then most certainly, if someone has a stroke, that's certainly not going to erase those deficits, but it can certainly help someone live more peacefully, more calmly, and possibly continue to reduce their risk if their blood pressures are better. So there's a lot of interplay. It's all really is simple yet complex at once, in the sense that there's a kind of a bottom line, which I love, for the American Heart Stroke, that they really kind of talk about. They used to call it life simple sevens, but it is kind of what you would say to anybody, whether we're talking about stroke, cancer, heart disease, stress, anything. I will always try to encourage my patients to put themselves in the very best state you can put yourself in. That means try to eat well, try to sleep, try to exercise. You know, they are simple, basic, but those types of things. Watch your sugar. Treat your blood pressure if it's high. Walk every day. Get some movement of your body. You don't have to run marathons. You don't have to, you know, be on the Peloton. You know, but you need to move your body. You know, and if life simple sevens, and it's not always easy for everyone. And I certainly understand that. And a lot of people have mobility issues and vision issues, and there's a lot. So what I kind of say as a basic prevention is, if you can do everything you can to keep yourself as healthy as possible, we're going to all get older no matter what we do. You know what I mean? And we just really want to manage our weight. We want to manage what we can, because those acts of kind of self-care, manage your stress level, like you said, whatever it is, some people love to exercise to manage their stress. Mm-hmm. Some people lay down on a Sunday afternoon all day and do nothing and read the book. Some people go to yoga. Whatever it is, do things to optimize your health. Because when you develop risk factors that you might have a familial tendency towards, or Some people get AFib out of the blue, atrial fibrillation.
Now, what is that? We talk about it all the time, but some people may not know. So
atrial fibrillation is a rhythm disturbance of the heart. The heart has rate and rhythm, right? It goes 60 to 100 a minute, and it's a normal sinus rhythm. It ba-boom, 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 atria ventricle, atria ventricle, atria ventricle. Atrial fibrillation is a situation where there's many more atrial beats compared to the ventricular. So instead of one to one, bump, 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 it's going to be five atrial beats, one.
And atrial is where the blood's coming in? Or
blood returns from the veins into the right atrium, and it goes into the right ventricle, and it goes through the lungs, and then it goes back right in the left atrium and the ventricle. So the atria are the top part of the heart, and the ventricle is the bottom. And ventricles push it out through out of our body into the aorta. So the atria is the top part, top chambers, two chambers, and that pumps it into the ventricles, and it should be one to one. When the atria are pumping rapidly compared to the ventricle, instead of one to one, you might have 5 to 1, 10 to one, 3 to 1, 6 to 1, 4 to 1, all over. And therefore, since the heart is also a pump, you don't have good pumping action. You don't have boom, 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 boom. You've got blood, you know, so you've got many of the atria and only one. So what happens in that heart when there's not really perfect pumping action, over time, the heart can begin to fail. Like when any pump fails, right? The muscle can get bigger. But the biggest thing to know about atrial fibrillation, and this is why atrial fibrillation is an independent risk factor for stroke. Atrial fibrillation happens to many people as we age. Sometimes people will come in with strokes that don't even know they're in AFib, you know, kind of thing. So what happens is, when the heart does not have that effective one-to-one atria ventricle pumping, what happens is the blood is not being coming in and leaving the heart in the correct swoop it's supposed to do that. It's supposed to be in, out, for lack of, that's kind of a little bit simplified, but that's kind of how it works. What happens is when you have that boom, 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 when you have that irregular, that pump isn't working, what happens is that atria, especially on the left side, doesn't fully empty. It doesn't empty all the blood out. And some of that blood tends to sit in a little pocket in the heart. And it just sits there because it's not getting pumped out. And over time, what does blood do when it pools? It clots. So if blood sits there and isn't getting pumped out in that little part of the heart, at any time one of these pumps, this stroke comes along, a stroke of the heart, it can pump out, and that bloodshot, that blood clot that's been sitting in that little chamber can get shot right out through the left ventricle, through the aorta, up to the brain. And that is why people with AFib are at such risk of a stroke. AFib, as I said, is an independent risk factor for stroke. So you can have nothing else going on with you, and if you have AFib, your likelihood of having a stroke is about 5 times more than someone that doesn't have AFib. So we want to treat that as soon as we identify it. And that is that's something that a lot of people develop as they age, or not a lot, but you know, people develop as they age. And I'm not sure, you know, how do you prevent that? You know, we always check thyroid functions. We check all kinds of labs and stuff, but sometimes it just happens to people and that causes stroke. So, so that's another big thing. We always will work up. Do we have AFib, and do we, what we need to do to treat that?
And if you have just tuned in, I'm Rhonda Fineman, and you are tuned to the Healthy Options program on WERU Community Radio. We're speaking with Eileen Hawkins, certified stroke registered nurse and certified neuroscience registered nurse. And the topic is stroke awareness, prevention, and treatment. And we're learning so much here in our program today. So we have this sense of blood clotting. We have to, so that would be some sort of blood thinner or different, to prevent some of that, there are foods to eat that some things make blood clot more, some things don't. You know, we have all these different options to deal with not just AFib, but just in general about how we keep ourselves healthy. And you mentioned something about looking at thyroid and looking at other things. What happens when you get the workup? Someone Oh, by the way, why don't we just review for people who just tuned in what the signs are, when you need to get to the hospital and why you need to get to the hospital if you're having any of this. And then we'll go back to what the workup would be.
So if you wake up or you develop a sudden onset, okay, and that might mean waking up with these things, but I'm going to say if you have a sudden onset of any of these five things, then you will want to go to the emergency room right away and let us evaluate you. And they are the following. Sudden onset. And the key is sudden onset of numbness, weakness on one side of the body, of the face, arm, and or leg. Okay. And it's one side of the body, sudden onset, numbness, weakness, or of the face, arm, or leg, sudden trouble, confusion, sudden trouble with speaking, trouble, sudden confusion, trouble understanding, any type of language or speech types of, but language understanding and communicating, sudden onset, abrupt onset of confusion. I'm not able to know what you're hearing and seeing and processing and being able to talk about it. Sudden trouble seeing in one or both eyes. That can be blurry vision. It can be a blind spot in the eye. It can be a blind eye completely. Corners of the eyes get blocked for tunnel vision, any type of blurry vision or unable to move your eyes, the movement of the eyes. Trouble walking with dizziness, loss of balance or coordination. All of a sudden, very common thing I'll hear is somebody was watching TV and they were trying to do the remote control and they couldn't control the remote control. Like it fell out of their hand and they couldn't move it. So that's new. And then sudden severe headache with no known cause, a severe sudden onset of a bad headache and out of the blue. So those are the five signs of a stroke, which means when, if that happens to you or you witness that, get a person to the emergency room for a rapid evaluation by the doctors and nurses in the emergency room. We would love to send you home and say, you're not having a stroke, but you need to get to the emergency room to be evaluated because there are acute treatments, but they have to happen in the first several hours after a stroke because otherwise you might miss an opportunity for treatment. So we can still take care of you. We will still do everything we can to treat what's going on. But the best treatment we have for an acute stroke, especially the blood clot type of stroke, which is the most common type of stroke, is a clot buster drug. And that drug can only be given up to about 4.5 hours from the time that you have your stroke. So you need to get to the hospital right away. Okay. And now, if you have a bad stroke, there are some cases where there are treatments available beyond that window. Okay. They can go up to 24 hours if the blood clot is big enough and it's amenable to surgical extraction. Okay. In some cases, we can send a patient to Maine Med. And if they can't get the clot buster drug and they have a big blood clot, they might be eligible. Not every patient is eligible for these treatments, but there are techniques where now the neuroendovascular surgeons can actually retrieve the clot that's in the brain through an endovascular procedure. Unfortunately, what you need to know is not everybody can get that. Okay. So we just tell people to get to the hospital fast.
What is the name of that drug?
We give patients in the emergency room, if they are within 4.5 hours of the onset of their stroke, they can get a drug that's called tenecteplase or alteplase is the another drug, but we have shifted from you. It's the same class of drug. It's a clot buster drug. We shifted from alteplase to tenecteplase a few years ago, as most people are around the country, because it acts just as quickly, but it's given in a one shot dose, and it's the same drug that we will use for heart attacks at these smaller hospitals, like where we're going to give them that drug and then get them down to Maine Med to have the endovascular procedure for their heart. So tenecteplase is the drug. We call it TNK, and it is being used standardly for clot busting drugs.
That's really good to know. So
up to 4.5 hours. So Yeah. Something happens to you on your strength, get to the hospital because you may be eligible for it. So not everybody's eligible for it. Again, if you have certain, like if, for instance, if you just had surgery, you can't get that drug because we can't give someone who just had surgery a big blood thinner. It's basically a massive blood. It breaks up a clot. The clots that go to the brain that cause the blockage need to be broken up. We can't let, so if you just had surgery, let's say a week ago, chances are you might not be able to get that blood because we can't give that drug to you. Certain blood disorders, some people have some bleeding history, some certain, if you have your platelet count is low, there's another example. And there's a few other conditions that we can't give that drug. And so not, but the vast majority of people can indeed get that drug, but a few people can't.
Would anemia be a factor as well?
If you have a clotting disorder, that's, there are some strokes that can indeed be caused by a clotting disorder. If you have certain condition that causes you to clot. Anemia certainly is low red blood cells. So you don't, but it's more of a clotting disorder that where there's a problem with blood clotting. And sometimes people develop blood clots because of certain factors in their blood. And when someone has a blood clot that goes to the lungs or to the brain, that can be a stroke. And that can also be treated, but the cause of that stroke is different than, let's say, an atrial fibrillation, or, you know, the cause of that person's blood clot might be their actual, in fact, part of a workup we will always do in every stroke patient is looking to see, do they have a clotting disorder, you know, of some sort, especially in the cryptogenic strokes where we can't see any risk factors here for stroke. Let's work up, does this person have a clotting disorder?
So the cryptogenic, for those who just tuned in, is the kind of stroke that it's not obvious exactly why this person is having
that a stroke. That will be part of a workup for a cryptogenic stroke.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to be asking family history. Of course, you have to treat someone pretty quickly.
Family history and checking tons of labs. Right.
Right.
Right. And sometimes that workup continues after a person goes home because they're doing well and we don't really know why they had their stroke. So now let's look at your blood. Do you have any problems with clotting, any kinds of conditions that would cause your blood to clot?
And you're doing that because we don't want another stroke. So,
well, absolutely. So what you need to know is what causes a stroke. And then that, and what kind of back to what I alluded to earlier, our goal, my dream, everything about people that take care of stroke patients, just like with heart patients, is primary prevention. We would love to prevent heart attacks and strokes. Once someone has a heart attack and a stroke, our efforts immediately go to figure out two things. Why did they have that heart attack and stroke? And now, what can we do to mitigate their risk of having another one? Because if you do not mitigate the risk or treat whatever caused that stroke, you will have a recurrent heart attack or stroke. And that is where secondary prevention is absolutely vital. And the focus of education in the hospital, the focus of follow-up visits with all your doctors. And we really want to teach people, okay, you had a stroke because you have AFib. This is what AFib is. This is what you need to do to manage your AFib. You had high blood pressure. You need to take your high blood pressure medication. You'll need to lose 20 pounds. You need to stop smoking. Whatever it is, we try the secondary prevention. We really try to support people with those lifestyle changes that are going to allow them to make those healthy changes.
That's really important.
What you know, Rhonda, is that if people can manage their risk factors, they definitely reduce their risk of having another heart attack and stroke. There's just no question about that.
That's very optimistic. I mean, it's actually encouraging. It's actually encouraging because there's something we can do. I'm noticing we've done a lot of shows here on aging, healthy aging, mm-hmm. and isolation and is such a huge piece of some people not doing well as they get mm-hmm. older. And I've been reading about stroke that loneliness is mm-hmm. actually considered a factor. And it's different than isolation. It just is perhaps you don't have a support system. And I'm wondering how you're dealing with that. You know, we have all these things, eat well, do this. And then there are these other aspects of social lifestyle. How do we encourage people or help people feel connected in a community? Well, what are you noticing in your situation?
You know, that is a huge factor for all health conditions, right? Loneliness and being alone and not and so it would be safe to say loneliness in and of itself is not a risk factor for stroke. Okay. However, the conditions associated with someone suffering from loneliness, where they're really impacted by that loneliness, those they're likely to have other conditions or situations in their lives that are making them more likely to have poor health problems in general, not just stroke, right? Because maybe they aren't and there's a lot in the literature these days about socialization and depression. And certainly we do know that when someone has a stroke, they're at an increased risk of post-stroke depression if they are isolated and they don't have the support system. So it all interplays, and it's really vital that where you're going with this is brilliant in the sense that what we want to say is it's all part of what we try to tell people, that prevention, let's optimize our mental and physical health, because that ultimately will all play together and keep us healthier in the long run. And that is just one more piece of that puzzle. And then, you know what, Rhonda, when people are lonely, they aren't communicating, they aren't interacting, they aren't getting out to the store, they may not be buying healthy food, they might just be alone, they might be not moving their bodies because maybe they're sad and they're watching TV all day instead of taking walks with friends. I mean, there's a lot of lifestyle stuff that comes in here. So it all goes back to those healthy, keep your mind and brain, do everything you can, socialize, communicate, and then sleep, eat, try to do all those things, because it all plays together. And certainly when those things are lacking, the recovery of illness is so much harder.
Yeah, this is so important. And of course, if one has to get to the ER very quickly, we just hope that there is the ambulance is available or someone is there to call 911. Because as we know, sometimes when you're having a stroke, you don't remember. I mean, it's like, it's not like, why didn't they call 911? Because they couldn't.
Well, that is a problem. And I will always tell older patients or people living independently that don't necessarily have another support system nearby. In fact, I had a young woman at a recent talk in Rockland ask me about this. She was young. She was only 50 something. She wasn't elderly, but she was 50 something living alone. And she expressed a fear to me, what happens if I'm home alone and I can't get to the phone? And this particular person did have some risk factors for stroke. She did have some health conditions. And I said, honestly, if I were you and you are concerned about that, I would wear a life alert button, because that allows you, if you fall, and I encourage all people who are living alone that fear that not being able to communicate to have some sort of resource button. It's hard to, it's hard to tell a 40-year-old to get a life alert system, you know what I mean, when they're out. But if you really are alone and you're fearful of that, and then this is particularly appropriate for the older population here, I do encourage people to have that life alert, because, and you'll be surprised. And you know, a lot of people that have parents that are in their 70s and 80s and 90s, a lot of people like me, my mom's in her 90s now, I'm thrilled to have my mom have one of those. Do you know what I mean? And because I know that even though she may be very good, independent 90-year-old, if she were to fall, she would not be able to get to her phone, and you can only have. So I do encourage people to think about having a life alert system where it does somehow notify somebody that you are needing help.
Well, that's it. And hopefully you're catching all of the symptoms, which could be numbness, weakness, numbness, yeah. Confusion, trouble seeing, trouble walking, severe headache. And you will recognize that this is something that you have to deal with right away. And again, if you can, it's sometimes hard.
very simple to people. We are a society that lives in denial. We don't want to believe that. And I make this joke all the time because I am always running around like a chicken with my head cut off. And I always say, I don't have time to have a heart attack or stroke today. Okay. I just don't have time to have one today. So I can't tell you how many people put off going to the ER because my chest, I don't know. I got to go to work. Or I can't tell you how many people go to work and their coworkers, maybe they haven't talked to anyone all morning because they're by themselves or they're somebody's sleeping and they get to work and a coworker has them talk and they realize
they're incoherent,
blurred, or their face is crooked, or somebody, if especially if they live alone, they haven't had the opportunity to talk to somebody, right? And they get to work and all of a sudden they have, or I can't tell you how many people will tell me, and this is, we've seen this over the years, how many people will say, I had to go to work, lobstermen will go haul their traps. We'll have people go to work because they have to be at work, and or I'll go after work,
right?
Or the other big one I hear commonly in the ER is I woke up, my face was numb, I couldn't really move, I thought I slept funny, so I went back to bed, and 2 hours later it wasn't any better. In fact, it was way worse. So my point is, don't be aware. These are possible signs of a stroke, possible signs of a stroke, and if the sooner you get treatment, the more likely you are to recover from that. And then we can start to figure out why you had that stroke and get you secondary prevention to try to have you not have another one. So go to the hospital, let us evaluate you. We will see you fast. We will diagnose you fast. And if you can get treatment, we're going to give it to you.
So all another reason why we need local rural hospitals in our community.
I can't say enough about the wonderful stroke care delivered through MaineHealth, through Penn Bay and Maine and Waldo. And I'm talking about people in our region, you know, in the Rockport, right. Camden, Belfast region. Wonderful, wonderful stroke care delivered to Waldo. Yes. And Penn Bay through our teams and through the assistance of MaineHealth telestroke services. And it has changed lives. It is huge. It is.
Which is, of course, why we need our local hospitals. So just.
We need our local hospitals. Oh, my God. You couldn't live without them, right? You couldn't live without them for these kinds of things.
Make a huge. Exactly right. And there it's and of course we need our ambulance services. We need all of that. That's getting people. If you only have 4.5 hours and you've already realized it took you 2 hours to realize that something's going on and you need help.
Well, that's the problem with a rural state. Very good point, Ron, in the sense that's why we tell people don't waste time because you gotta get to us and but don't be afraid to call an ambulance and don't do what patients will tell me sometimes. Oh, I'm going to wait till my son gets home from work. No. You don't, because you can't. Time is brain.
Time is brain. A stroke is really a destruction of the brain cells, isn't it?
It's death of brain cells that aren't getting blood flow, whether it's a blood clot or whether it's a rupture of that vessel. It's not, and we have to get the source of that repaired. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we will not get blood flow to the brain. And when blood flow doesn't get to the brain, those cells will die, ultimately impacting the function. It's just that simple.
You know, it's so interesting. Some of the things I've been reading, and we were talking about some of the books written by survivors, or Stroke of Insight, for instance, this particular individual who happened to be a neuroscientist, and it took her 8 years to recover, but she was so adamant that she needed people to understand that it may take time, but she can recover. That there was so much of the negative, you've lost this, you've lost that. And we do focus on that. But what she talks about is what she needed most. She needed encouragement to remind her that she will recover. And she was saying that she had a hemorrhagic stroke, and her brain was being flooded with blood. The blood was going where it shouldn't. And she was not, she said she got into the right brain where she was like, this is like amazing. It's just amazing how we are in the world. Look at us. We're amazing. And then her left brain would say, wait a minute, I have to get help. This isn't right. And it took a long time. She didn't have the button. It was 1996. She didn't have that to figure out how to get help. So those are the things. what is required? What do you do with your with the treatment to encourage people and to know that you might have the headache, you might have sensory overload, keep the lights low.
And well, the recovery of stroke is a whole another I don't want to say ball of wax. It's all a continuation. Right. But when patients recover, I want to first and foremost stress that what we do know, it is evidence-based, that patients that receive physical therapy, speech therapy, and occupational therapy, the therapies, cognitive therapy, you know, that kind of stuff, those patients that get early treatment, early therapies, will improve as much as they can, and they will continue, they can continue to improve. The brain is an incredible, you know, there's neuroplasticity, the brain can recover. And we are very evidence-based in that we start therapy. Our goal is to get that evaluation done within 24 hours of that person coming in. They get evaluated. And I'm telling you, hats off to the therapists. They are the next, the other, there's so many amazing groups of people that do their special thing with stroke patients. They provide them an evaluation. They actually look at the true nature of their deficit and they focus their therapy, speech, language, occupational therapy, behavior, cognitive therapy on the patient's deficits, and they work with them. The recovery in the hospital is very intense, one thing. And then we always try to send people to a rehab facility, or, and if they aren't quite needing a rehab facility, we get them home with home therapies and the ongoing therapy, and then the support, the from families, friends, caregivers, getting them to these therapies, working with them and helping them, because, and then that secondary prevention that I keep talking about, let's make sure I don't have another stroke, because once I've had a stroke or a heart attack, I am at risk of having another one, because whatever caused it is still there. So I've got to do something. So we combine the secondary therapy with all of the therapies and try to get those patients.
And I know talking about the, first of all, the name of the book we were talking about was My Stroke of Insight, by Jill Bolte Taylor. She's a doctor, a neuroanatomist, which is kind of amazing. And the other thing is, I do know someone who is a musician and who had a stroke, and part of his therapy down in one of the rehab centers in Portland was to play his instrument. They were really able to integrate. So, you know, these people are quite amazing.
We want motion. We want physical therapy. We want muscle memory.
Well, we're talking about that. Let's talk again about the BFAST. Maybe just go through that really quickly as we get to the end of our program. Of course, you and I could go on for hours as usual, but please just quickly give us that. And let's do the BFAST this time.
Okay.
And
so this is based on the fact that what we want everyone in the community to know is that stroke is a sudden onset of one of these issues. Okay. It's a sudden onset and there is treatment for stroke, but we need people to get treated quickly, not in 2 weeks, not tomorrow. We need them to get to the hospital. So it is incumbent on us sometimes as people in Shaw's or people in the hospital or with friends, somebody has a sign of a stroke that we talked about,
which would be balance,
which would be sudden onset of weakness, numbness, tingling, one side of the face, one side of the body, or arms, legs, interface, sudden trouble, confusion, sudden trouble with speaking or understanding, sudden problems with dizziness, balance, equilibrium,
vision.
Vision, a sudden loss of vision in one or both eyes, and finally, an unexpected, unknown cause of a sudden onset of a severe headache.
Severe, it's killer headache.
And you see that. There was a lady in Hannaford, in Rockland, a few months ago that had a stroke. We saw that. You say, you call 911 and say, but use the acronym BFAST. Balance, eyes, face, arm, speech, and time. If somebody has any one of those new things, they have a positive BFAST.
All right.
Call 911.
That's it. We were done. And our guest today on Healthy Options has been Eileen Hawkins, Stroke Program Coordinator at Penn Bay Medical Center in Rockport. Thank you so much. So much information. We'll have websites and info on our archives. The show will be archived at weru.org. Thanks to Joel Mann and Amy Brown for at WERU for engineering support. support, Petra Hall for production assistance. And as always, thanks all of the WERU listeners and supporters. I'm Rhonda Feynman, wishing you the best in health.